countries could swap pictures and learn nothing. But another satellite was accidentally discovered, then another and another. They were neither Pakistani nor Indian, and they were not supposed to be where they were found, each about 300 miles above the Earth, moving north-northeast at a constant speed of 120 miles per hour, and each maintaining a distance of 400 miles from the other. Over 10 days, the terribly excited hackers monitored the movements of at least 6 different satellites, all apparently part of the same system, as they slowly approached from the Arabian Peninsula, swept through the skies over Afghanistan and Pakistan, then headed off for western China. They told no one, but instead managed to procure a more powerful satellite telephone from the military, claiming it was needed to follow up some unfinished work with the Indian surveillance. After a month of methodical 24-hour monitoring, they had pieced together a global web of 9 identical satellites, all linked to each other and all carefully designed to be invisible to everyone except the men who launched them. They codenamed their discovery Neptune. The 3 young wizards had been educated in the United States. Their leader was Safi Mirza, a former Stanford graduate assistant who had worked briefly at Breeden Corp., a renegade U.S. defense contractor that specialized in satellite systems. Fazl Sharif had an advanced degree in computer science from Georgia Tech. The 3rd and youngest member of the Neptune gang was Farouk Khan, and it was Farouk who finally wrote the software that penetrated the first Neptune satellite. Once inside its computer system, Farouk began downloading intelligence so sensitive that he and Fazl and Safi knew they were entering no man's land. There were clear color pictures of terrorist training camps in Afghanistan and government limousines in Beijing. Neptune could listen as Chinese pilots bantered back and forth at 20,000 feet, and it could watch a suspicious fishing boat as it docked in Yemen. Neptune followed an armored truck, presumably Castro's, through the streets of Havana. And in a live video feed that shocked the 3, Arafat himself was clearly seen stepping into an alley in his compound in Gaza, lighting a cigarette, then urinating. For 2 sleepless days, the 3 peeked inside the satellites as they crossed Pakistan. The software was in English, and with Neptune's preoccupation with the Middle East, Asia, and China, it was easy to assume Neptune belonged to the United States, with Britain and Israel a distant 2nd and 3rd. Perhaps it was a joint U.S.-Israeli secret. After 2 days of eavesdropping, they fled the apartment and reorganized their little cell in a friend's farmhouse 10 miles outside of Karachi. The discovery was exciting enough, but they and Safi in particular wanted to go one step further. He was quite confident he could manipulate the system. His first success was watching Fazl Sharif read a newspaper. To protect the identity of their location, Fazl took a bus into downtown Karachi, and wearing a green cap and sunglasses, he bought a newspaper and sat on a park bench near a certain intersection. With Farouk feeding commands through a ramped-up sat phone, a Neptune satellite found Fazl, zoomed down close enough to pick off the headlines of his newspaper, and relayed it all back to the farmhouse, where it was watched in muted disbelief. The electro-optical imaging relays to Earth were of the highest resolution known to technology at that time, down to about 4 feet, equal to the sharpest images produced by U.S. military reconnaissance satellites, and about twice as sharp as the best European and American commercial satellites. For weeks and months, the 3 worked nonstop writing home-brewed software for their discovery. They discarded much of what they wrote, but as they fine-tuned the successful programs, they became even more amazed at Neptune's possibilities. 18 months after they first discovered Neptune, the 3 had, on 4 Jazz 2-gigabyte disks, a software program that not only increased the speed at which Neptune communicated with its numerous contacts on Earth, but also allowed Neptune to jam many of the navigation, communications, and reconnaissance satellites already in orbit. For lack of a better code name, they called their program JAM. Though the system they called Neptune belonged to someone else, the three conspirators were able to control it, to thoroughly manipulate it, and even to render it useless. A bitter fight erupted. Safi and Fazl got greedy and wanted to sell JAM to the highest bidder. Farouk saw nothing but trouble with their creation. He wanted to give it to the Pakistani military and wash his hands of the entire matter. In September of 1998, Safi and Fazl traveled to Washington and spent a frustrating month trying to penetrate military intelligence through Pakistani contacts. Then a friend told them about Joel Backman, the man who could open any door in Washington. But getting in his door was a challenge. The broker was a very important man with important clients and lots of significant people demanding small segments of his time. His flat fee for a one-hour consultation with a new client was $5,000, and that was for those lucky enough to be looked upon with favor by the great man. Safi borrowed $2,000 from an uncle in Chicago and promised to pay Mr. Backman the rest in 90 days. Documents in court later revealed that their first meeting took place on October 24, 1998, in the offices of Backman, Pratt, and Bowling. The meeting would eventually destroy the lives of everyone present. Backman at first had seemed skeptical of JAM and its incredible capabilities. Or perhaps he had grasped its potential immediately and chosen to play it sly with his new clients. Safi and Fazl dreamed of selling JAM to the Pentagon for a fortune, whatever Mr. Backman thought their product might fetch. And if anyone in Washington could get a fortune for JAM, it was Joel Backman. Early on, he had called in J.C. Hubbard, his million-dollar mouthpiece, who still played golf once a week with the president and went bar hopping with big shots on Capitol Hill. He was colorful, flamboyant, combative, thrice divorced, and quite fond of expensive whiskeys, especially when purchased by lobbyists. He had survived politically only because he was known as the dirtiest campaigner in the history of the U.S. Senate. No small feat. He was known to be anti-Semitic, and during the course of his career, he developed close ties with the Saudis. Very close. One of many ethics investigations revealed a $1 million campaign contribution from a prince, the same one Hubbard went skiing with in Austria. Initially, Hubbard and Backman argued over the best way to market JAM. Hubbard wanted to peddle it to the Saudis, who he was convinced would pay $1 billion for it. Backman had taken the rather provincial view that such a dangerous product should be kept at home. Hubbard was convinced he could cut a deal with the Saudis in which they would promise that JAM would never be used against the United States, their ostensible ally. Backman was afraid of the Israelis, their powerful friends in the United States, their military, and most important, their secret spy services. At that time, Backman, Pratt, and Bowling represented many foreign companies and governments. In fact, the firm was the address for anyone looking for instant clout in Washington. Pay their frightening fees, and you had yourself access. Its endless list of clients included the Japanese steel industry, the South Korean government, the Saudis, most of the Caribbean banking conspiracy, the current regime in Panama, a Bolivian farming cooperative that grew nothing but cocaine, and on and on. There were many legitimate clients and many that were not so clean. The rumor about JAM slowly leaked around their offices. It could potentially be the largest fee the firm had yet seen, and there had been some startling ones. As weeks passed, other partners in the firm presented varying scenarios for the marketing of JAM. The notion of patriotism was slowly forgotten. There was simply too much money out there. The firm represented a Dutch company that built avionics for the Chinese Air Force, and with that entree, a lucrative deal could be struck with the Beijing government. The South Koreans would rest easier if they knew exactly what was happening to the North. The Syrians would hand over their national treasury for the ability to neutralize Israeli military communications. a certain drug cartel would pay billions for